listening to a program produced in 2010 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more about Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. We are here tonight really to celebrate the power of boundless compassion, which is a pretty wonderful reason to gather. That is the subtitle of Father Gregory Boyle's powerful new book, Tattoos on the Heart. And I know, and I'm sure many of you also know, that Father Greg is a very modest man, but I think most of those of you who are here tonight would agree with Marion Wright Edelman, president of the Children's Defense Fund, that Father Gregory is a national treasure. His work is a living example of the power of compassion and love. Father Gregory Boyle, best known as Father Greg by all who meet him, is an LA native. He's one of our own. His father was a third-generation Irish-American who worked in the family-owned dairy, and Father Greg was one of eight children. After graduating from Loyola High School in L.A. in 1972, he decided to become a Jesuit and was ordained a priest in 1984. He received his B.A. in English from Gonzaga University and an M.A. in English from Loyola Marymount, a Master's of Divinity from Weston School of Theology, and a Sacred Theology Master's degree from the Jesuit School of Theology. And I don't usually just rattle off degrees, but no doubt I realize that those degrees in English may have served him very well over the years as an articulate spokesman for the cause that he so passionately believes in. 2008 marked the 20th anniversary of Homeboy Industries, which Father Greg began. And Homeboy Industries is recognized as the largest gang intervention program in the country and has become a national model. Homeboy offers hope to those for whom all hope is lost, and that is really a literally true statement. But what this new book, Tattoos on the Heart, also reveals is that Father Greg is an extremely gifted storyteller. You see, those degrees did really come to something. He's able to give us a window onto the lives of those affected by gang culture, particularly in a spiritual context. He is a writer who writes from the heart with humor and honesty. Tattoos on the Heart is a gripping and emotional read. It's really quite a deep experience reading this book. And we could not be more joyful than to help Father Greg celebrate its publication and his work and the work of Homeboy Industries. Joining Father Greg tonight as our interviewer is award-winning journalist Celeste Freeman, the author of G-Dog and the Homeboys and the upcoming An American Family. Celeste is the creator and editor of WitnessLA.com. She teaches journalism at USC Annenberg School, and she's a visiting lecturer at UC Irvine. And our third guest from Homeboy Industries is the illustrious Luis Perez, and I know that we'll learn more about Luis's story tonight. And I'd also like to give special thanks to Leslie Schwartz, who teaches writing at Homeboy Industries and who's worked tirelessly alongside Father Greg to make this book a reality. So without further ado, please welcome our special guest to the LA Public Library. Thank you.
My giant purse. Hi there. I first met Luis about 2 years ago, but I first met Father Greg in the fall of 1990 because I'd heard about this priest guy who was having good luck in working with gang members. It was before he, you know, was profiled on a regular basis on every news network in the country, and then they rerun it continually. And before 60 Minutes. And I thought that he'd had good luck with gang members. It was the height of the gang crisis in Los Angeles. I mean, we still have gang crime that blows unimaginable holes in our families and communities. But at that time, it was the decade of death where gang crime and gang murder reached the highest point it's ever been before or since. So it sounded like he'd make an interesting story. And I came down to Dolores Mission Parish, where he was the pastor, one night. It was the night of a young woman's funeral. I wasn't sure what the story would be. I talked to my editor at the then Los Angeles Times Magazine, when the Los Angeles Times really had a magazine. We won't go there. Into letting me probably do an article, but she wanted to know a little bit more. Is he for real? I mean, what's the dark side? It's a question for quite a while. I was going, you know what? He won't ask for directions, but there really is no dark side. even the saints among us, not perfect. Anyway, I had a crisis of sorts in my own life that day. My four-year-old son, who's now 24, ran away from home with money out of his mother's purse and neighborhood across the kid across the street took money out of his mother's purse, and they went and played video games. And it's the only time before ever that I've called the police, because he was away and I thought the worst. And so when I finally drove to Dolores Mission, my life was feeling, the world was feeling scary. I was a single mother. It felt like a very scary world. I mean, there was all this gang violence. I drove up to this church and I thought, you know, nobody's going to know me, and I'm some middle-aged white lady in a white Honda Accord, and they're going to jack my car. I'm now walking into a group of bereaved, heavily armed adolescents, and this is really something I should have thought through a little more thoroughly. When I came, the casket was open, and it was the part of the service where the young men and women were filing past the casket, and the person who had been killed was a young woman who had been shot in the head a couple of nights before, leaving behind a young daughter, and all these homeboys and a few homegirls were filing past the casket and sobbing and stroking her cheek and dropping stuff into the casket, small mementos and whispering terms of endearment. And these people that were being portrayed as monsters on the nightly news and who were wreaking unimaginable havoc in the city of Los Angeles would then leave the casket, and then there was this guy standing off to the side, bearded guy. And he'd taken off his vestments by that time, and they would collapse in his arms and just sob. And then they'd go out the side door and into the parking lot to smoke and talk and, you know, sort of gather themselves. And that night I never talked to anybody. I watched Father Greg. I didn't even introduce myself. And I walked through the crowd, and of course, you know, they didn't care who I was, and nobody even noticed me. But I looked at how these young men were relating to this guy. And they were filled with tenderness and vulnerability, and the hardness was gone, and my life absolutely changed that night. I mean, really, no kidding. You know, there aren't that many times in your own life that you can say, this time, everything that was became different. And I saw that they were just kids. And I stayed and did an article, and then I did a book, and bungee corded myself to Father Greg's ankle for 4 years. Poor him. But the thing that changed my life is I saw his effect on these young men, but more than that, I was thinking about it today, and that Father Greg lives as though the truth were really true. We all, I know that sounds like a weird thing to say, but it and it's not mine. It's, you know, I'm stealing a quote from someone else. But most of us kind of know the right thing. We know that compassion is the way we should is the way we should treat our fellow human beings. But we don't always live from that place of the truth that we know is true. Father Greg lives as if the truth were really true. I met Luis Perez when every so often I get asked to speak and I wanted some homeboys to come with me because they're more interesting than I am. I'd requested a couple of guys I knew, and one of the guys was unavailable, so they sent this other guy. And I thought, well, I don't know him. And who I met that day and who came to speak in front of, I think it might have been George's class, at UCLA was this remarkable person. Lewis is 30 years old. He spent approximately 12 of those years incarcerated in bits and pieces. He last got out of prison in September of 06. Right now, he's the senior navigator. I'll let him explain that later on, for Homeboy Industries. And he's just a remarkable, bright, compassionate man who has changed his own life and now helps other people change their lives at Homeboy Industries. So with that introduction, oh, the thing I should tell you, that Tattoos on the Heart has been on the LA Times bestseller list now 6 weeks in a row. And I know, yay! It's one thing for those of you who haven't read it, not only is it filled with compassion and humor and amazing stories, but it's a really wonderful literary work. This guy has 3 master's degrees. You know, I'd give him manuscripts to read over to make sure I wasn't going to get anybody killed, and he'd start line editing. I'd go, no, don't do that. Not in your job description. Father Greg still changes my life over and over and reminds me to live as though the truth were really true. So, you're kind of in the transformation business, helping people transform their lives. I mean, that might be an oversimplification. But one of the books that, I mean, one of the stories from the book that as I was reading along was a story about a kid named Speedy, who you and I both know. And I remember there were weekends where it just didn't seem like he'd live through the weekend. But there was a particular story that you tell in the book, and I wonder if you'd has transformation built into it, because then if you tell us where Speedy is now.
Okay, thank you. I just want to say, what I remember of meeting Celeste was I asked the homies, so who's the white middle-aged stalker with the white Honda Accord?
That's mean.
That's how I remember it. So anyway, privileged to be with both of you. So Speedy is, I just saw him the other night. He was one of those Evel Knievel guys who used to kind of run into enemies' neighborhoods. You know, people talk about, I talk about gang violence being the urban poor's version of teenage suicide. So that it's, I've only buried one kid who killed himself. But I think priests and pastors and ministers in this city, in almost every other parish, would say, oh no, I've, you know, buried lots of kids who've killed themselves. But I've only buried one, but I've buried 168 who've been killed by gang violence. So the typical way to do this is to sort of put yourself in harm's way. So Speedy did this a lot, and he would go over and stick his tongue out to enemies, and I'd get red in the face, and I'd say things that my mom never taught me to say, and I just would get crazy mad with him. And sometimes I had to rescue him. He was over in enemy neighborhood, and he got stuck there. So he went into somebody's house, a total stranger, and he called me and said, I'm over in East L.A. Duke's neighborhood. Help! Get me out of here, you know? So it was, and he just didn't care. And so once he came into the sacristy just before I was about to say Mass, I was late for the 5 o'clock Mass, a bunch of old ladies out there looking at their watches, and I'm saying, I'll be right out, and I'm putting on my alb and everything. And he comes in, and he slides his elbows on the formica top, and he says, you know, I just don't care whether I live or die. And I, you know, I'm embarrassed to say, I'm just worrying about how am I going to get, I got Mass right now, don't launch into this now, so... But I said, you know, it's going to have to, you know, do that I care whether you live or die. And he seemed to kind of take that in, and it mattered, I guess. Well, cut to several hours later, I'm in my office. I was pastor in those days, and he, open door policy, and it's open. They can see it's open from the street. And he came in, and he said, now don't get red at what I'm about to say. And, you know, this begins the reddening process, actually. And, and I said, what happened? He goes, well, I walked Anna home. Well, Anna was this young girl beautiful girl that he was quite sprung on. And he deposits her in their apartment in the housing projects in Aliso Village, right in the heart of his enemy's neighborhood, East L.A. Dukes. And as he walks down the stairs, only then does he encounter like 10 members of the gang. And so they chase him through the projects, and they're throwing sticks and stones and empty bottles of 40-ouncers. And they don't call him Speedy for nothing, and he gets out of there. And he encounters a woman named Yolanda, and Yolanda doesn't know him, but she knows that he currently shouldn't be where he currently is. She comes, ven para acá, mijo. ¿Qué está haciendo aquí? What are you doing? And he hangs his head kind of in shame, really. And then this virtual perfect stranger says the following thing in Spanish. If anything happened to you, it would break my heart in two. You know, I've seen you play with your nephew in the park. What a good uncle you are. You know, I've seen you feed the homeless man at Dolores Mission Church. What a good and generous thing that is. Pero te digo una cosa. If anything ever happened to you, it would break my heart right in two. Now, vete, get out of here. He comes and he tells me this story. After he tells me, he says, you know what, G? That shit made me feel good. Well, of course it did. And then he continued on his path, and he ended up being tired, I suppose. And we got him a job in an oil refinery, a dangerous job, cleaning the inside of huge oil tankers. And then he got transported to Richmond, California, and married, three kids, and pretty soon he was the supervisor of, you know, other people who were cleaning the tankers. And so he... I remember he called me once, and he said, well, I'm taking you out to dinner. I'm going to pay, he says. So he came to L.A. We went to a little modest steakhouse. And I'm asking him, you know, he was going to school. He had become this huge supervisor, owned a home. And talk about success, you know. I said, well, what do you do, like, on the weekends when you're not studying, you're not working? Like, what do you do on Sunday? And he was very quick. He said, on Sunday, we all go to Mass. 9 o'clock Mass. Then afterwards, we go to Mimi's Cafe. The kids love Mimi's Cafe. They can order anything they want. And after that, we go to Barnes & Noble for 2 hours. You know, my cheap ass won't buy a book, you know, but But we each grab a book, and, you know, they'd be having comfortable chairs at Barnes & Noble. And when the 2 hours up, we say, let's go. And everybody, no la hace, put the book back. You'll be back next week. And he goes, matter of fact, the kids kept wanting me to buy that recent Harry Potter book. So I bought the Harry Potter book. And then he gets quiet and he says, now, you know what we do every night? I sit in my recliner and I listen to my kids read out loud. The oldest, she reads the whole page, and they sit on the couch, and she passes it to her brother. He reads a paragraph. They pass it to the baby. He reads a sentence. They kind of help him. Then they pass it back, page, paragraph, sentence. And now he's starting to cave in a little bit. And he says, And I just sit in my recliner, listening to my kids, read out loud. And he puts his hand up to his eyes and he starts to cry, and we're both sort of surprised at the turn this story has taken. Finally, I reach across his half-eaten steak and I grab his arm and I go, "You got a good life." And he looks up at me and he says, "Yeah, I do." That's Speedy.
I was looking at something here, listening to that. I've talked to I don't know if he's still there, the DA, Deputy District Attorney, who's in charge of the hardcore gang unit, and the head of the CCPOA, which is the Correctional Officers Union. And in two different instances, they both sort of in an unguarded moment said, "I've never seen the CCPOA, the prison guard president, said, I've never seen a prisoner that I really thought could transform." And I brought a bunch of journalism students in to meet the head of the hardcore gang unit, you know, really good guy, very generous with the students. And at the very end, he said the same thing. He said, "Well, you know, but of course, I really don't think gang members can change." I'd love to ask you in a minute what you say to those people. But first, as an answer, I'd love, Lewis, for you to just talk about what you went through when you went, what it took for you to change, and what part Homeboy played in that.
Well, I've known Father Greg since I was 13 years old. I met him in East Lake Juvenile Hall, trying to get out of my room, so they asked who wanted to go to Mass. And of course, I want to get out of my room, right? You know, that's the first time I had ever met him, you know, and, you know, I had been to church before, and, you know, people use these big old King James Bible verses that I don't understand what they're talking about. And Father Greg was talking about, you know, he connected to me at where I was at, you know, and he was talking about Chuko, the guy on the street, and he was connecting it and comparing it to the Bible and making me understand what God was really saying, you know. And after that, he came up to me and he gave me his card, you know, as we were walking back to the units. And he says, "Here, call me. You deserve more than this." You know, growing up in a normal, dysfunctional family, right? You know, those words are very hard to swallow sometimes, to believe that you deserve better than what you see on a daily basis. You know, the earliest childhood memory that I have of my mom, my father, and me and my sister was my mother being beaten from the bedroom to the living room where me and my sister slept, beating her as if she were a man in front of us, while me and my sister begged and cried, asking them to stop. And as years passed, and I give my mom a lot of credit because she left my father, but growing up, my mother, an alcoholic, you know, and I was fortunate enough to have my father's good looks. I was her scapegoat, and all she would do is tell me how I wasn't worth nothing and that I would never amount to nothing, and I was just like my father. So as I constantly kept visiting juvenile hall and going to camps, they became my home instead of, you know, my vacation, right? I kept meeting him, and he kept telling me, and he kept having conversations with me, and he kept telling me I was better, and, you know, that I was worth so much more, and I felt the sincerity behind that, you know? And no matter how much I would mess up and keep going back to juvenile hall where I would meet him, he never judged me on my mistakes. He seen something deeper. You know, at the age of 16, I got arrested for a very serious case. I was looking at 25 to life at the age of 16. You know, I didn't call my mother. I didn't call my, you know, I didn't call a lawyer, but I called Father Greg and he showed up. you know, so he showed up and he told me I would have to go through some things, you know. I stood there fighting my case for about 2 years. I got, I lost my juvenile fitness here. I got trialed as an adult, went to the county jail. Every birthday, you know, on the dot, I would get a letter from him just wishing me a happy birthday. Wow, look at what a homeboy has done to me, right?
Just what when you said that, I think of what I've observed with Father Greg is how many, you know, he's like the best with remembering birthdays, like the best. And his cards are, he gives me like really weird animal cards. Yeah. but that he's so good at that. But very often, as you're saying, that with a homeboy or homegirl, it will be the only card they've gotten.
You know, the thing that I was gotten was that, you know, just consistency, you know, compassion, love that I've never felt before, and hope that I can be better than that I was told as a child, you know? And that's what homeboys provided. When I got out, because the building was there and because I had his card in mint condition still, I showed up at the doors and he was, I asked him, hey, you know, I don't know if you remember me, you know, you did my first communion in camp, you know, I went in a boy and came out kind of an adult, right, physically at least, and I showed up and he's like, yeah, I remember you, Camp Miller, and you start tomorrow, and, you know, it was a transition, it was a fight. An inner fight, you know, spiritual warfare was going on amongst myself, right? Because I kept thinking that I didn't deserve it, self-sabotage. And I went back out to the streets. And even on the streets, I got caught up with drugs. You know, I had a homie that passed away. And on the streets, I would hear about, the homie would tell me before he passed away, he was like, man, I'm going to go to Homeboy Industries because they don't judge me on the way I look, you know? You know, Homeboy is just a place of hope. It's a place that when its doors are always open and you know that there's a man there that doesn't judge you for what your outer appearance is or but what bad choices you made as a child or as an adult, he's still there to open his arms and welcome you. And that's what Homeboy provides. And it's helped me in my change.
Thanks, Lewis. You know, there's so much at Homeboy that is transformative in its nature. And one of the things is, you know, that you always talk about, Greg, is the transformative power of work. And I hope I'm going to get that. I know all the names in the book have been changed away from the lawyers made you change the names. But one of the stories that struck me is kind of a double-decker story of compassion because it seems to transform the person who offers it and the person who receives it. Is a homeboy named Anthony and a guy you know named Dennis? The car, the mechanic.
Oh, yeah.
The changed names through...
Danny, I kept Dennis. He just died, actually, the mechanic. Anyway... yeah, let's see. Mary Ridgway, who in Boston, Wisconsin, was a legendary probation officer. She called me one day and she said, "You got to go check in on this kid, Danny. He's living in a car. I don't want to arrest him. Parents are heroin addicts and missing in action, but he's living in a car. So I don't know. You'll find him on, you know, such and such street, Michigan, and something." So I went looking for him and I found him. I introduced myself. I said, "Do you want a job?" He said, "Yeah," and he was living in a car. He was selling PCP just to, so he could go down to Jim's and order a pastrami madness, which is something the homies eat—a real coronary kicker. And I said, "Yeah." So, what would you like to do? He go, "I want to be a mechanic, but I don't know nothing about them, about cars." So I went to my mechanic, who was this guy, Dennis, just the best mechanic in the days when Cesar Chavez was called Brooklyn Avenue. And he was not a man of few words. He was a man of no damn words at all. The guy just chain smoked. So he always had a cigarette hanging out of his, you know, and you'd go, hey, Dennis, you know, here's the keys to my car. There's some noise under the hood. And he would just take the keys, and you come back the next day, car was running like perfect. No words were exchanged in the course of this interchange. And he would just light one cigarette after another. He absolutely would never say a word. So I remember I sat him down in his office, and just the original smoke-filled room. And I said, okay, Dennis, there's this guy, Danny. He's from a gang. You know, his parents are, he's abandoned. He's an orphan. He lives in a car. He wants to be a mechanic. And so I start doing my song and dance, and he just takes long drags on the cigarette. And then, you know, I redouble my efforts, you know, ripple effect, Nobel Peace Prize, anything to kind of to get him to you know, be open to hiring this kid. And then I find he just still takes long drags. And I kind of stop. I go, well, I don't know. I tried as best I could. And then Dennis took one long final drag on his cigarette and smoke wafting in front of his face. And this is the only thing he said to me that day. He said, I will teach him everything I know. And so Danny began to work with Dennis, and you know, he would check in with me. He'd call me and or come by, and you know, I just learned how to do a lube job, and I just fixed a carburetor all by myself. And once he came in and he presented a picture to me, and in the picture there's Danny, tiny little guy, in work shirt, Danny emblazoned over here. And a face covered in axle grease, big, huge smile, and no doubt at all that this job had transformed this kid's life. But standing next to him with his arm around him and a cigarette hanging out of his mouth was Dennis, and equally certain that hiring this kid had changed his life as well.
Sometimes... there's, you know, Danny was a kid with a lot of potential, and some of the people I know who walk into Homeboy are you know, are still struggling with themselves, or you know, it's four steps forward, three and a half back, and one of the stories in the book that reminded me about you should never give up on anybody is a story you tell about a kid you call Crappy in the book. Crappy. I'm going to try that one again.
Yeah. Simon and Schuster don't know how to change the names, and in we will call Snoopy
Crappy.
Sorry.
One of those moments I'm happy I write for a living, not speak for a living. But his real...
Is it Magoo?
It's Magoo. And if you tell... I'll talk about who he was and who he came to be.
Yeah. One day I'm in my office, in my current office, and also the prior office. We're in our fourth headquarters now, but in our third headquarters, it was the same deal. It was a glass-enclosed office, so I can look out onto the floor of Homeboy Industries, and I know who walks in. And sometimes you kind of, you know, sometimes it changes the temperature, and Lewis knows this better than anybody because he's right out there. You know, if four guys come in deep, then you respond, you know. It happens. So I'm in my office, and I see Magoo walks in the door, and I'll be honest, my heart just went to the basement. I knew that Magoo had just gotten out of like a 7-year stretch in prison. This is the first time he's ever stepped in my office. And, you know, let's just say we didn't get along famously. I had met him when he was 15 years before, I guess, or maybe it was 20 years. I've known him 20 years. But when he was a 15-year-old kid, his probation officer assigned him community service hours at the church when I was pastor. You know, and I don't have to do what you say, like that, you know. I see the gacho right in my mascara, as the homies would say. And I go, whoa, you know. Cut to like 3 years later, I'm preaching at a homily for one of his homies, a guy named Hector who had been killed. And I'm standing in front of the aisle, you know, down below, and I preached not from a pulpit, but right there, you know, if you were at church. And I said, if you guys love Hector and you want to honor his memory, then you'll put down your guns and you'll love your enemies and you'll work for peace. And all of a sudden, from this group right here, Magoo stands up. He walks angrily to the center aisle. I stop speaking. I don't know what to do. He walks straight toward me, stops right in front of me, mad dogs my ass like crazy, and turns and walks out of the church. Cut to about 3 years after that, I'm on my bike in the middle of the night driving through the projects as I did in those days. You know, put that Uzi down. Are you sure you want to shoot that guy? And so I come upon a group of gang members who are in a kind of what we call a bola. There's a circle, and clearly two guys are fighting in the middle. And so I throw down my bike, I break through the crowd, and it's Magoo fighting a homie of his named Smiley over, as the homies would say, a hyena, a female. I break up the fight. Well, this pisses off Magoo quite a bit, and he reaches into the front of his pants, and he pulls out a gun and waves it wildly. Well, his homies are more horrified than I am. You know, they're going, damn, dog, put the gun away, you know, and don't disrespect G like that. And he aims the gun right at me, and he kind of laughs. He goes, I'll shoot his ass too. Are you getting a sense of our relationship here? Yeah. So my heart sinks when I see him, oh, kind of walk through the door, and his homeboy Gus was the receptionist at the time, and he intercoms me, you know, and his voice is kind of cracking. Hey, G, it's Magoo. You want to see him? You know, and he knew that this was might be in some doubt, you know. So, Of course, yeah. So, you know, I brace myself, and he comes in, and he hugs me. But, you know, we've known each other for 20 years. It would have been awkward not to. And he sits down, and he says, look, let's just talk man to man. Look, I've never disrespected you. I figure I'm going to go for it, you know. So how about the time you walked down in the middle of Hector's funeral or the time you pulled a gun out on me? And he thinks and he goes, well, besides that. And then I saw Magoo do something I'd never seen him do in 2 decades of knowing him. And honest to God, I'd never seen him do this. He truly, truly laughed. And it made me laugh. And I remember folding my arms down on the desk and rested my head on my folded arm. We just laughed, laughed, laughed. And when he finishes laughing, he sits up and he says, I have spent the last 20 years building a reputation for myself. And now I regret that I even have one. And then he does another thing I had not seen him do in 20 years of knowing him. He begins to sob. And I mean really, truly, uncontrollably sob. And he holds his head in his hands. And I wait. When he stops crying, he looks at me and he says, now what do? I know how to gangbang. I know how to sell drugs. I know how to shank fools in prison. I know how to drive. I don't know how to park. And I only know how to wash my clothes in the sink of a cell. Now what do? So I hired him. I said, you start tomorrow. And he worked on our graffiti crew. And some months later, he was killed. But I think he had a taste of the truth of who he was, that he was exactly what God had in mind when God made him. And as I always say, no bullet can pierce that. No 4 prison walls can keep that out. And obviously, there are lots of things that are worse than death, and not knowing that truth happens to be one of them.
And I remember that out of one of his first paychecks, he gave money to a homegirl who was caring for the child of one of his former homeboys who had sort of fallen into the chasm of despair of drugs and alcoholism, and so was on the street and couldn't care for his little boy. And he walked up to her out of nowhere and said, thanks for what you're doing for the homeboy. And I don't know if you remember, but Gustavo Martinez Grumpy paid for his funeral ribbons.
Enemies.
Yeah, I you talk an awful lot, both in the book and just generally, about how enemies can work together. And this is somebody who, you know, they were mortal enemies. I remember Grumpy said, well, figure he'd changed. I'd changed, and he'd changed too, so.
Grumpy. Should I say something about Grumpy?
Absolutely. I mean, speaking of, you also talk about, before we get to the enemies, about Grumpy, you talk about the burden that a lot of people have to carry, and he would be one.
Yeah, you know, I always say that gang members are never seeking, kids are never seeking anything when they join a gang. They're always fleeing something. And I think that's always true. I don't think there are any exceptions. Sometimes gang members will self-present and say, you know, join a gang, see the world. You know, that's what I wanted. When I was horrified once to see a homie on ABC National News. He was being interviewed in the back of my office. I didn't know. And, yeah, when I was a kid, that's what I wanted. I wanted money and cars and women. And that's what I wanted to be. Well, this is what, it's in the homie manual, you know. This is what you say if you're interviewed by ABC News. But you know, Grumpy was, he's my compadre, you know, and I've known him forever. But you know what? His mom used to put cigarettes out on him and hold his head in the toilet and flush till he nearly drowned. A story I hadn't heard was that he had, one summer, at the beginning of summer, like June, I don't know, I think he was 9, he was thrown out of the house by a woman I just going to have to presume is mentally ill. And he wasn't allowed back in the house till the end of summer. He lived like some kind of feral animal, like in the backyard, did not bathe, did not change clothes. Neighbors felt sorry for him and fed him. The backyard was his bathroom. So he ran away from home at 13. This seemed like a reasonable thing to do. And he joined a gang because misery loves company, and that's where kids go. And I met him when he was 19. I have to admit, I didn't like him. I remember I met him one night when Puppet Michael was shot, and he was bossy, and he was in my face. I go, fool, you know, get out of my face. And I was annoyed by him, but we became fast friends. And then he ended up living in the shelter. Remember that? And we got him a car and a job. And once he came up to me and he said, I want to call my mom. He was doing so well. I said, are you sure? She's the only mom I got. He hadn't spoken to her in 5 years. Use my office. So he goes into my office, and he's out of the office in like 5 minutes. He looks like he's seen a ghost. And this is what the woman who brought him into the world chooses to say to him after not having laid eyes on him in 5 years. She says this and only this: tú eres basura. You are garbage. And I remember looking at him, his eyes welled up with tears. And I said, you didn't believe her, did you? He said, nah, I forgave her. Pretty remarkable. Cut to years later, he was living by himself and doing okay. And his car was in the shop. So he came by Homeboy Industries and he said, could you give me a ride home? I said, sure. So he lived in Montebello at the time. And he said, since I got you in the car, can we go to Ralph's so I can do my shopping? I said, sure. He's a big, huge guy. And he grabs the cart and I just followed him, and he was going fast and he knew what to get. And he said, you got to come on Tuesdays. That's when the sales are. I'm okay. And I'm following him. And at one point, he turns to me and he says, you have to be very careful when you shop in big supermarkets. I go, you do? He goes, yeah. I go, why? He looks around. It's that elevator music they be playing. You buy shit you don't need. And he was home sweet home in his own skin, you know. Anyway, I digress.
And then another decade later, he paid for the funeral ribbons for someone who
That's right.
His mortal enemy. Actually, I remember with Grumpy when my own son was being bullied in the fourth grade. And we all tried to give him sensible advice, just ignore him, blah, 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 you know, act like it doesn't matter. I happened to mention it to Grumpy, and he said, you tell your son to tell that little fool that if he doesn't stop it, I'll come up there and have a word with him. Now, he was kidding, but the idea for my fourth grade son that this very large, heavily tattooed, you know, a homeboy who had mastered the art of the scary stare could turn up on the upper playground of Topanga Elementary really it was fulfillment of one's desire and fantasy that really worked. It, you know, he just never got bullied in the same way after that. Also, Crazy Ace calling from prison, talking to my son, saying, just ignore him, which is what we told him. That worked, too. Anyway.
But he had to hear it from a gangster.
He had two. One who was going to be his bodyguard, and the other one who, you know.
Grumpy the other day was telling me a story, standing in front of my desk, and he was very, very involved story. And when he gets to the surprising turn in the story, instead of saying, and lo and behold, he says, and holy befold. And he actually thought that was the expression, holy befold, you know. And around the office now, it's become, you know, I think it's a better phrase, you know. Come to Homeboy Industries and holy befold, seriously.
Miracles will happen.
Yeah.
You know, I've thrown out my notes, but at some point I was going to ask you about homeopropisms. Instead of malapropisms, you have a whole list of things the equivalent of holy befold. Any others you'd like to share?
Oh, God, there's so many, you know. One I like, it was a homie who I was baptizing, and he was just kind of a nervous little guy, and he knew who I was. I didn't know who he was, and we were in the gym at Central Juvenile Hall, and so I want him to feel special. So I shake his hand, and I go, hey, after we had talked about what we're going to do, And I'm honored to be the one to baptize you. And he grabs my hands and his eyes fill up with tears and he goes, clockwise. Not that kid, but another kid who was so nervous. And I always tell them beforehand, I say, you know, here, the only two things you need to know, I'm going to ask you two questions. What is your name?
Jose.
Okay, good. So far, so good. And then I'm going to say, what is it that you ask of God's church? And you just say baptism. You got that? Okay. Well, when the time came, I knew we were in trouble because he was hyperventilating. I go, oh, my God, in front of all the kids at juvenile. It was in the gym as well. And I said, what is your name? Jose. What is it that you ask of God's church? I want to be a Baptist. Yeah. So,
which one? To New York?
Yeah, I told him that you're in the wrong service, dog. So,
yeah, sorry.
This one was with Lewis, where we went to in New York and D.C. and we spoke before a congressional subcommittee and so you were asking Grizz, this big huge guy, Big Joe. He had never been on a plane. You know that we had to get seatbelt extensions and stuff. And so we were going to New York. So Lewis is from New York, and he says, "So what do you want to see in New York?" You know, and Grizz knew exactly what he wanted to see. I want to see the Empire State Building. I want to see the Statue of Liberty, and of course, you know, the Eiffel Tower. And Lewis, you know, just wanting to kind of gently bring him down. Fool, that's in Paris.
Not to humiliate him or anything.
Then he said, well, maybe I'll take it off my list then.
You ended up going to the Holocaust Museum.
Maybe.
Didn't you? And Lewis, you were the person who ended up having a whole experience in there.
Can you tell us?
What did that mean to you?
Well, we went to Washington to address Congress and stuff. on some things. And then, excuse me. And then we ended up going to the Holocaust Museum where they give you, you know, a card of someone that either that person made it to the Holocaust or passed away. And then as we went through the whole thing, we seen the shoes and inside the train carts and everything. We were walking out. There was a man right there, and it was sign. It was a sign right there that said "Holocaust Survivor." And you know, I was like, "Oh, look, gee, you know, there's a Holocaust survivor over there." He's like, "Well, go and talk to him." So I walked over there, and we started talking. I started talking to the man, and I asked him, you know, what camp was he at? And he started telling me, and he just started telling me about how. Do you remember the camp?
Auschwitz.
I can't pronounce Auschwitz. And we go and we start talking, and he starts telling me, you know, how he lost his, you know, his four brothers and his sister and his mother. And he started telling me about the things that were going on there, you know, how he was, you know, how
there was a boy
when he was a boy and stuff. And then I started talking about juvenile hall and how I was raised in juvenile hall and the things that I've been through and the abuse and, you know, not to compare, but just that I understood, you know? And he just looked back and he looked at me and he just kind of like started shaking his head and he's like, wow. And, you know, it was just like immediately there was a sort of, you know, just bond that we created. Because we both, you know, the abuse he had been through and the abuse I had been through, there's no comparison, but there was a bond that was created between just the suffering that we both suffered and the loss of people that we both had lost.
Well, Lewis, I love that story, and it brings me back to the question of when there are people like the deputy DA who thinks that people can't change. What do you say to somebody like that to see if you can open their heart?
You know, it's...
Because you're a product of transformation.
You know, the thing about Homeboy Industries is, like, it's stories. Like, you know, with Father Greg's tattoos on the heart, it's stories, you know, change is possible, you know. I mean, you know, Martin Luther King has a statement, a quote that says, faith is taking the first step without seeing the staircase is there, you know. And but there has to be someone that provides that faith and provides that hope. The only reason people don't believe that is because they haven't opened their eyes to see the things that are right in front of them sometimes. You know, we get caught up in seeing the outer appearance of people or the things, you know, the first cover of what people have been through because of their tattoos or because of their jackets, their records, right? But when you really sit there and really look at the person and hear what they've been through and hear what they've suffered and hear what they've lost and see what they overcome, you'll see the change. But a person has to have his eyes open.
Well, that's what I always feel like. Go to Homeboy Industries, check it out. And it's hard not to have your eyes open. I recommended lunch at Homegirl Cafe. You know, it's the best. It's a wonderful day if you haven't been there. Two more things, and then we'll open it up for questions. One is, Greg, you know, you've divided up the book into these different chapters that are, you know, about compassion and one about success, which will be my second question to some degree. But one of your last chapters is kinship. And I've just been holding that concept in my head so much lately, and I wondered if you'd explain that and the whole notion of outside the circle of our kinship, and if you have a story that illustrates that you want to...
Well, I mean, the whole book is about kinship. It's about, you know, committing to create a community of kinship such that God might recognize it.
you know, so much what Homeboy does.
Yeah, in Jesuit circles, you know, you might see in institutions, you know, of education, you know, service is sort of premier, you know, and sometimes we will say be men and women for others. But service is sort of, I always say it's the hallway, but it leads to the ballroom, and the ballroom is kinship. You don't want to stop at service because there's still a distance. Service provider, service recipient, you know. You know, I love Lewis. He's my son, you know. But it's a complete mutual thing, you know. It's not I'm the service provider and he's the service recipient. You know, he's returned me to myself as much as maybe I've helped him. So there's no daylight, and that's what you want. You know, Mother Teresa diagnosed the world's ills correctly when she suggested that we've just forgotten that we belong to each other. So, you know, and then I'm always saying suddenly kinship so quickly, you know. So I hand out cards all the time, thousands of them, at probation camps, just like his newly minted card. And often they bring them out of their wallets after being in prison for a long time, and they're yellowed and wrinkled. And I always say, you know, the same thing, come see me right away. We'll help you as soon as you get out. Don't delay. Don't slow drag. I won't know where you are. Now you'll know where I am, and I hand them my card. But come immediately. I had a kid today right out of camp. So this kid, Louis, came in, 17-year-old gang member, happier than a clam. He goes, here I am. I just got out yesterday. And you are the very first person I came to see. And never in my life had I seen more hickeys on a human being than on this guy, Louis. It was unbelievable. It was his whole neck covered. His cheeks were spotted with it, you know. And, you know, Mr. Guinness of the World Records might be interested in talking to Louis, you know. And I looked at Louis and I go, Louis, I have a feeling I was your second stop. Well, I mean to tell you, we just died laughing, and there was no distance, you know. It was suddenly kinship so quickly. Which sort of raises the issue of the current situation we're in at Homeboy Industries, and the fact that a kid came in from camp today. And normally I do what I did with Lewis. You start tomorrow. Or Miguel, Magoo. You start tomorrow. But I couldn't say that to this kid today because you're going to hear it in the news. It'll be in the LA Times probably on Saturday that we've had to lay off 300 people today. And the businesses are going to stay open. And we're not in trouble again. It's the same trouble from 6 months ago where we kind of said, this costs money and we don't know how to do this. And the businesses bring in about $3.5 million, and that's good. But it's just so tough. And today was a very emotional day. I didn't sleep last night because I knew this was... And I told Lewis and the navigators, yeah, go ahead and tell people. But I'll announce it tomorrow morning. So I came back from lunch, and oh, my God. It was everybody was hugging me and saying, we'd work for you for free. And don't, you know. So I made my way crying into my office, and I go, oh, my God. And then, Lewis, you take it from there. You said, we need to meet.
Yeah, we're going to wait till tomorrow morning just to start letting people know. But just people started, you know, calling Los Angeles Times and people started calling Channel 7 News. It just, everybody's, how can we make money? Where can we go? We had a couple people at the Placita Alvera saying, come and take a picture with a gang member. They were selling.
Who's not going to want that?
Yeah. Selling shirts, selling the book. And, you know.
But talk about the meeting. Yeah. Because he came to me. It was your idea. You said, no, we need to meet now. We can't do it tomorrow. I said, you know, I'm not prepared to talk about this right now.
Yeah.
No. And again, he's brilliant. He just says, nope, we got to do it now. And it was something about Arlene. She wants to say a prayer, and everybody knows about this now. So
it was just, you know, it was interesting how you know the news spread like wildflower, you know, wildfires, and oh, there's another one, but wildfires.
Which is to say slowly and through the ground. And...
with a lot of love.
You know, we gathered up. We do this every morning, but we did it today in the afternoon.
At two in the afternoon.
Two in the afternoon. Everybody got together and people's tears in their eyes. And we joined together. And it was just amazing. You know, people
I guess we didn't
expect
it.
You know, it was like just to know that we all love him and we all appreciate everything that he's done for us. And we had a guy, Dennis, that, you know, started... He prayed, and we all locked hands, and we just started praying for hope. You know, the hope that Father Greg has provided for so many of us that have walked through his doors. Hope that there will be someone that will write a check and, you know, help us out. And, you know, it was, you know, it was indescribable, the feelings and the energy and just the tears of just a family coming together. You know, a place where rival gang members work side by side. You could never tell that none of us ever shot at each other or we didn't get along. It was just a love, you know, a love that was only there because a building was opened by a man's vision, you know. And that, you know, it's just indescribable, you know.
Well, it's sort of like, it was like Frank Capra meets Whoville, you know. It was, there's the Grinch had stolen all the presents and then he's listening. And everybody's singing, and it was pretty incredible. And with a combo burger of, Mickey Rooney, let's put on a show and charge admission. That all day long, people were handing me money and sobbing, and I mean, it was really all we did all day long was hug and tell each other how much we love each other, and sob. And as they all walked out today, they said one thing: "See you tomorrow." Now, they're not going to be paid. And we're encouraging everybody, including myself, to go on unemployment. We're going to keep the businesses open, and we're going to keep the doors unlocked. And they all said, we're going to still help people find jobs and tattoos removed. But a kid came out right out of camp, and I couldn't do what I would normally do. Come on in.
Well, you normally have 427 people working there, and it's, you said you just laid off 300, and I talked to your business office, and it's closer to 330, I think, and that's a pretty, and they're coming in as part of the family, but these are all people who need income, so that means the services like tattoo removal, job development,
mental health counseling.
And you know, anger management, and on and on and on. So what you, and you have 12,000 people walk through those doorways every year.
Again, you know, I love Homeboy Industries, obviously,
Los
and
Angeles?
It's been around for 23 years. And we kind of sounded the alarm 6 months ago. And I think people look at our brand new building and they go, they'll land on their feet, I guess. I don't know what people think. The question for our city really is, who are we willing to rescue, you know?
I mean, the Hollywood sign.
The truth be told, $12 million for the Hollywood sign. I love Tom Labonge and
like
save
the
Hollywood
sign.
I don't begrudge that. You know, we're willing to rescue Museum of Contemporary Art. I love MoCA. But $30 million and then $30 million matched, and we both sounded the alarm at the same time. That's $60 million endowment. That's not city, county, state. That's people. And trust me, no animal shelter in the LA County will ever be in danger of closing its doors, ever. And I don't begrudge that. I think that's fine. But it says as a society that a Warhol and a Hollywood sign and a puppy are worth more than the 12,000 human beings like Lewis who walk through our doors every year. That doesn't get me angry. That just makes me sad. But that's the way it is. And I don't know.
So if any of you know Oprah Winfrey, I'm not kidding. If
you buy enough books and it becomes Tuesdays with Homie, You know.
With that,
I don't know. Do writers actually get money from books that they sell?
Theoretically.
Yeah. So I don't know what we're going to do, but keep us in your prayers. And it looks like question and answer time. We got microphones.
Yes.
Because it's 8:10.
Sure. Questions. Have we stunned you into submission?
Just raise your hand. They have microphones behind you.
They have there's over here and then here. Okay, sir. I have my reading glasses on.
Good evening, Father Grave. Central Juvenile Hall, 1990, 91, sentenced to life in 93. And I made it out 75 days ago. Please don't give up. That's the answer. Thank you.
And right down here.
Thank you.
Father Greg, my name is Eddie. I was there today at 2 o'clock. I went for the anger management, and I saw how you guys all gathered up there, and I saw how all the news you broke down to everybody, how everything was going down. I even filmed it today. I know Hector. He's a nephew of Abraham. I'm at Amistad de Los Angeles on Grand.
Uh-huh.
And just to let you know, anything you need for free, I can volunteer my time. Anything you need to get yourself back on track or whatever, and, you know, wash a car, go
thank you.
Down, whatever.
Everybody wants to wash my car.
So, you know, don't forget.
Hey, you're
about
great.
That.
Thank you. We'll see you afterwards. Thank you very much.
There's a hand, I think, in back.
Actually, the news is out. We heard this distressing news on the radio coming here, of all things. And I wondered if it's possible, the only magazine I've ever seen this done with is The Nation, when somebody like Katha Paulett or another writer speaks about a worthy cause, they tell you how to get in touch and how to contribute. Is it possible to do this through any of the media? And do you have a blog and website?
Yeah, we have a website, homeboy-industries.org. But part of the thing today was,
you know,
we did this, and then the homies in the Mickey Rooney will put on a show in charge admission spirit. They went to everybody. They went to Power 106, ABC News. They called the LA Times. We were kind of thinking, gosh, you know, let's just hold off, and do we really want to do this? And they did it without asking permission. And they sent out these kind of press releases. And some of it was, you know, more alarming because the businesses are staying open and we don't want to suggest. And again, we're the opposite of a sinking ship. I mean, the odd part about it is in 90 days, Ralph's is about to hugely market all our salsas from Home Girl Cafe in all their stores, you know. We're on the cusp of that, and we're on the cusp of having Homegirl Cafe in the new extension, and we hope in the airport it looks good, you know, and Patina has just signed on as a customer at our bakery, and the French baker who's now taken over is just amazing bread. So, my gosh, you know, we're about to take off, and people, the poor get Homeboy Industries, you know, they send in checks of $10 in sort of the Obama democratization of fundraising school, you know, that happened a lot. And by some miracle, I don't know how we cobbled together all the pay periods we have, you know, since November. But our luck has sort of run out, and we're waiting for somebody to rescue us, frankly. You know, to the tune of like $5 million so we can bridge ourselves into the future where we're going to be just fine, but we don't know how to get there. And we serve the whole county, and there is no place that stands as a sign of hope not just for those who want to redirect their lives like Lewis and walk through our doors, but it's a sign of hope to those who aren't ready to walk through the doors and for those who are in prison. What were you saying today about the...
Yeah, just yesterday there was a guy that just got out. There's going to be a lot of guys that are going to be getting released from prison pretty soon that just from lifers and stuff. This guy came into our office, just served 23 years. He was just talking about how everyone in the prison system talks about homeboys, about wanting to come out and work there, you know, just the place that they're going to give, allow them the opportunity that no other place will give them. Who, you know, there's no other place in California or tell me in the United States that will hire someone just coming out of prison that's tattooed completely. You know, we have a friend, a guy named Marcos, and one time I took him to a meeting, and we went to a meeting to do a talk, and someone came up to him after, and they asked him, wow, that's a lot of tattoos there on your face. Completely covered. There's not an inch of space that shows his skin. And he asks him, wow, that's a lot of tattoos there. And he's like, why did you do that? He's like, it's a mask. I was hiding from myself. And he's at Homeboys now doing tattoo removal, trying to take them all off. You know, where else will you find a place that will hire someone like that? Nowhere.
But it's not like there's plan A, B, C, and D. We're it. And in the county of LA, that has public safety implications, it seems to me, because, my God, you know, if they can't come to our place, and that we still want them to come to our place, but our capacity to bring people in as trainees, which we've always done, is limited because we don't have the money. And people go, well, it's not sustainable. Your budget isn't sustainable. I go, it is if you want to sustain it.
Well, and
$10
million,
$50 million, you know, our budget is $7 million. I don't know. Compared to what? It's a bargain. It's a bargain for what this county gets.
And the cost of not giving people some kind of hope and opportunity is a lot higher. There, I think there's a woman over here that's had her hand up for a long time.
Want to say one thing. You know, price is only an issue in the absence of value. And the value for sometimes gang members is seen very low, you know. They don't think that there are some people that deserve to live more than others, you know. And that's the idea. And that's why it seems so hard to reach in their pocket sometimes to give, you know. And that's the honest truth, unfortunately.
My question had to do with law enforcement. What is your relationship with law enforcement? You've been doing your work for a long time. I imagine that you've got a longstanding relationship with them.
Great question.
Yeah, you know, in the early days, it was, you know, again, if you're in a period of demonizing, you know, and in the bad old days, I'll be honest with you, you know, it was hard. In the beginning, my first 5 years, it was really hard. Because demonizing was pretty pervasive among law enforcement with people like Lewis. So, you know, and then the friend of our enemy is our enemy. It was a pretty simple leap to demonize me. And the first 10 years of Homeboy Industries was bomb threats, death threats, hate mail. And that didn't come from gang members. That came from people who, why are you helping them? So, and I have to admit, I grew up, my experience of police was they were your friends. They got the cat out of the tree. You were happy when they arrived. That was my experience. If I was naive about anything, it was about law enforcement when I first, because homies would nonchalantly say, gosh, you know, they'd drop me off in enemy neighborhood, or they'd beat me down in the projects or in the factories trying to get information. They wouldn't charge me with anything. They barely wanted me to tell me this stuff. But I was so naive that I remember in the early days, I'd go to the captain at Hollenbeck and say, God, I think you'd like to know this. Somebody's beating these guys up. And then it was kill the messenger. And then I went, yikes, you know. But now that's changed, you know. I mean, really has changed. And I think the demonizing has changed in the city of L.A. I don't have any doubt in my mind that Homeboy Industries has only had lots to do with that, because it's a way of putting a human face on folks, and that really has happened. And I'm happy to say that law enforcement has a different take on this?
The current chief, Charlie Beck, is on one of the videos that is on the Homeboy site, pitching the Homeboy car wash.
Hi, my name is Hazel. My question is actually for her. I was really interested when you mentioned your son going and having a relationship with it, you know, men that were still on the inside. I mean, he sounds like he might have grown up into a very normal person. I mean, how did you manage that? I mean, from my side, it's not something that I can understand. It's just a little... I mean, did you ever have any problems with your son trying to idolize maybe the dark side of these men that were trying to, you know, change who they actually were?
I actually I'll just say that the ages of 15 and 16 were scary. I mean, he's Banga Canyon, and so, you know, there's really a short to Banga Canyon. But he had some other really scary trauma, and I mean, really, no kidding, scary. You know, he's got all this, but he didn't have an available dad, and so, you know, there was that bad hole that I've seen so much in the barrio, and my kid had it, and he, you know, I celebrated Mother's Day with him. He's 24, and he took me bike riding, and it worked out. But I was that no matter what person for him, and I thought it couldn't happen to my own kid. And yet the guys that walk into Homeboy Industries often don't have that no matter what person. I will do whatever it takes, and I did whatever it took. At some point, and at some point, it, you know, it took that. But that no matter whatness is what I see over and over at Homeboy Industries. Sometimes I've written a lot about things in and around it, and I'd have friends saying, "Why do you go? It's so depressing. You've been to all these funerals." Father Greg has been to 168. He's officiated it, but I've been to my share, And I go for the hope. I mean, it's just and really and truly because the miracles so outweigh the sorrow. And you know, it helped me get my own kid through the dark time. Okay, and yes. Thanks for asking.
I was released from prison in August, and I've been going back to prison for 18 years. And my friend Eddie right here told me about what was going on at Homeboy Industries, and I panicked, you know, because I've been going to tattoo removal since November, you know. And, you know, like Marcos, it's the last mask I got to take off, you know. So it's really important that these services are provided for us, you know. You know, and I introduced myself to Father Greg a couple months ago, and he probably don't remember me, but, you know. But, you know, my demonstration shows that I am an ex-gang member, and I'm saying that today publicly. Thank you.
And right down here.
We'll continue to remove tattoos. We're gonna continue to do everything. It's just we don't have the money to pay people to do it, but they're going to do it.
First of all, I want to thank Celeste and Lewis and Father Greg. My name's Leslie Schwartz, and I work at Homeboy Industries. And I want to say two things.
And she runs an amazing program that sometimes nothing stops a bullet like a job, but sometimes nothing stops a bullet like a poem.
We started a literary magazine, and we have a poetry class, or we did have, and it will resume. I'm full of hope. I want to say two things. The first is it was funny to hear you talk about Marcos, because 2 years ago I sat down with Agustin and Marcos, and I asked him about his tattoos on his face, and I said, "Are you ever going to take those off?" And he said, "No, never. They're me. They're who I am." And when we talk about transformation, to see him going through the pain of lasering these tattoos off 2 years later... It's to me, it's very symbolic to see that he's allowing his face to be seen. But I'm standing up here right now because I want to say to you that I love Homeboy Industries. I know what Celeste means when she talked about, I remember the moment I walked into that First Street office, I felt that my life had changed. And this has been a very, very difficult day for all of us. But as Greg's West Coast publicist, I implore you tonight to buy not one book, not two books, but seven books.
And 30's not bad.
Because there's birthdays coming up, and what's the next holiday? We can make
Father's Day. Father's Day.
Arbor Day. I don't care. Buy the book. Don't share it. Okay? Buy your own book. Because writers do make money. And when we earn out this advance, we will get royalties. And when we get royalties, we will begin to recover. That is one way that we can recover. Among all these other possible ways, all of you all who are standing up saying you'll come in and help us. I'd like $2 million. If anybody has it, that'd be great. But you know what? Tonight, this is a beautiful, beautiful book. I'm not saying that because I'm trying to make money for Homeboy. I'm saying it because I read it when it was in draft form, and it is the most beautiful book. It is a book of extreme literary merit. I say that because I'm a novelist myself, and I should know.
Please, and a very good one.
Support us tonight, and buy books, and don't share them. Buy your own, please. I have to implore you to do that tonight, and help us any way you can. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you, Leslie. I want to thank Father Greg and Lewis and Celeste. I want to thank you all for coming tonight. We do have envelopes for Homeboy at the counter where Father Greg will be signing his book. If you don't need those college endowments, feel free to write some checks. Thank you so much for coming. Father Greg, you're going to go that way, that way, that way, that way, that way, that way, that way. And we'll see you out in the lobby in a minute. Thank you.
Aloud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, Errant Fox, City National Bank, Deloitte, K&L Gates, KPMG, Wallace Foundation, the Bujakchi Foundation, Dean Hansel, and Donna and Martin J. Wolfe. Media support provided by KPCC, 83.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.